Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're embarking on a crucial journey through pediatric orthopedics. We're going to talk about the pediatric injuries of the upper extremities chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook, www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vayette. But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us, read the book. Our mission in this deep dive is to arm you with the precise, actionable knowledge you need to quickly understand and navigate these common injuries. Think of it as your shortcut to confidence when a child comes in after a fall.
Exactly. Imagine you're in the clinic, right? And a child with an elbow injury walks in. Our goal today is basically to give you the mental toolkit to confidently approach these cases. We're going to systematically break down the most common pediatric upper extremity fractures and injuries, looking at their unique anatomy, mechanisms, key diagnostic clues, and critical treatment pathways. We'll really highlight those specific details and potential pitfalls that truly make a difference in patient care.
Okay, let's unpack this with a big one that you'll definitely encounter. Supracondylar humerus fractures. Now, the name, supracondylar, literally means above the condylars. These are those rounded bony knobs at the very bottom of the humerus, right where it meets your forearm, specifically at that flared part, the distal humeral metaphysis. These aren't just common. They are the most frequent elbow fracture in kids, typically striking between, say, ages 4 and 8, often from what seems like just an innocent fall on an outstretched hand.
Yeah, and what's fascinating here is that while they all happen in the same spot, how the injury occurs dictates the fracture type. We mostly see two types, extension or flexion injuries. Mm-hmm. And this just refers to the position of that lower humerus bit, the fragment, relative to the main bone on an x-ray. Overwhelmingly, though, the extension-type fractures are what you'll see most often. They're like a classic high-stakes puzzle.
So you're on shift, a kid comes in, elbow pain, swelling. With a more severe supracondylar, you might even see an obvious deformity or maybe a telltale bruise, what we call ecchymosis. But here's where it gets really interesting and honestly high-stakes. The neurovascular exam at presentation is absolutely critical.
Right.
For extension type injuries, the common ones, you got to watch out for the anterior interosseous nerve. That's the nerve you need to make that OK sign with your thumb and index finger.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a flexion type injury, it's usually the ulnar nerve that's affecting the pinky and ring finger sensation.
And you absolutely cannot forget about the blood vessels.
No way.
The brachial artery running right there can have decreased flow. It could be stretched or it might go into spasm, especially if it's kind of tented over a sharp bone fragment.
So you have to check
every single time. Feel for radial pulses, assess hand perfusion, look at the skin color, check how fast that capillary refill bounces back. It's non-negotiable.
Okay, so that brings us to diagnosis. Plain radiographs, usually enough.
Usually, yeah. But you need a sharp eye. Sometimes, those non-displaced ones, what we call occult fractures, they're tricky. Your secret weapon here is the posterior fat pad sign. Basically, bleeding in the joint pushes this normally hidden fat pad away from the bone, making it visible, like a dark triangular shadow on the x-ray.
Okay.
Radiographs also show displacement. And a crucial diagnostic trick is the anterior humeral line. If you draw a line down the front of the humerus, it should normally cut right through the middle third of the capitellum, that little round knob on the end.
Right.
But in an extension type fracture, it'll pass too far forward or maybe miss the capitellum entirely.
And what about that sail sign you sometimes see?
Good point. If you see a sail sign, it looks like a triangular shadow, like a bowed sail that indicates an elbow effusion, so fluid in the joint. It often goes along with that anterior humeral line being off, which is, pretty classic for a type 2 supracondylar fracture. We classify these from non-displaced to hinged to completely displaced.
And when it comes to red flags, these fractures have some flashing neon signs. First, an ipsilateral forearm fracture. We call this a floating elbow.
Right. It's floating because the humerus is broken above the elbow and the forearm bones are broken below it. Sort of disconnects the elbow.
And the danger there is?
Big time increase in the risk of compartment syndrome. Huge.
And how do you spot that ticking time bomb?
Look for the three A's. Anxiety, agitation, and increasing analgesia requirements. If the kid's getting more anxious, restless, and needing more pain meds, that's an urgent clue.
Okay. What about a pulseless hand with one of these? That sounds terrifying.
It is, but there's a distinction. If the hand is pulseless, but still warm and pink, well perfused, you might proceed with reduction and fixation, then watch them like a hawk.
Hmm.
But if that hand is white, cold, pulseless, that means urgent operative exploration. You need to look at that anterior neurovascular bundle right away. That's a true emergency.
Wow, okay. So treatment then really hinges on the fracture pattern.
Exactly. Depends entirely on the fracture. If it's truly non-displaced, you're often looking at non-operative management, usually a long arm cast for about 3 weeks.
And if it's hinged or incomplete?
For those incomplete or hinged fractures, closed reduction and percutaneous pinning are often the choice. Sometimes just casting can work, but pinning is common.
And completely displaced ones?
Almost always require closed reduction and pinning.
When would you do an open reduction?
Typically reserved for cases where you just can't get the bones lined up properly with closed methods. Or, like we said, if you need to explore that neurovascular bundle because of a pulseless hand.
And the outcomes? Usually pretty good.
Yeah, the good news is most kids regain full elbow range of motion, often don't even need physical therapy.
But complications can happen.
Oh, sure. Pin migration, pin site infection, those are fairly common after surgery. Far more serious is compartment syndrome, either from the injury itself or sometimes from too much flexion during treatment. That needs urgent forearm fasciotomies to prevent permanent ischemic contractures.
And long-term?
Well, you can get cubitus varus or gunstock deformity where the elbow looks angled inward. That's usually from an inadequate reduction.
Mm.
It's often functional, but if it's severe, it can be fixed later with an osteotomy.
Okay, from the elbow's most common fracture, let's pivot slightly. Let's talk about medial epicondyle fractures.
Yeah.
These are often seen in slightly older kids, right? Especially athletes.
Exactly. Frequent in children, particularly between 9 and 14. And here's a key association you absolutely cannot forget. Something like 60% of these are linked to elbow dislocations.
60%, wow.
Yeah, it's high. And what's really remarkable here is the anatomy. The medial epicondyle isn't fully formed bone yet in these kids. It's an apophysis, basically a secondary growth center that starts ossifying around age 5 to 7.
And it's important because...
It's vitally important. Right. It's the anchor point for your flexor pronator muscles in the forearm, and critically, the ulnar collateral ligament, or UCL. That's the most important stabilizer against valgus stress on the elbow.
Like the inner brace of the elbow.
Precisely. Prevents it from bowing outwards. It's also the last growth plate in the distal humerus to fuse, usually around age 15.
Making it vulnerable.
Exactly. Particularly vulnerable to fracture under high valgus, stresses those forces trying to push the forearm outward away from the body. Puts immense strain on the inside of the elbow. That's why you see it so often in throwing athletes.
So a kid comes in, medial elbow pain. What history points are crucial?
Definitely ask if they felt any instability or if they had a dislocation that maybe popped back in on its own, self-reduced.
Gotcha. And the exam.
Always a full range of motion and neurovascular check. For imaging, AP, lateral, and oblique x-rays are standard, but they can be tricky, often underestimating the true displacement.
And the big worry, especially after a dislocation.
That the epicondyle fragment gets trapped inside the joint. That's a huge red flag. You really need to scrutinize those x-rays, make sure the joint looks perfectly lined up, congruous, and that fragment isn't stuck in there, incarcerated.
Might need a CT sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah. If there's doubt about displacement or location, a CT can help, though the treatment itself can sometimes be controversial based on displacement alone.
And differentials. What else could it be?
Well, a concurrent elbow dislocation itself, a UCL injury, or other elbow fractures. And for your young athletes with chronic pain, think about stress fractures or maybe a fibrous union from that repetitive valgus stress, like baseball pitching.
So red flags are instability, that cracking sound.
Crepitus, yeah. Or a mechanical block during range of motion. Those should make you highly suspicious for an incarcerated fragment.
Okay, how do we approach treatment?
Traditionally, non-operative management with a long arm cast was pretty standard for medial epicondyle fractures.
But there are times you have to operate.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolute surgical indications are open fractures, obviously. And any fracture where that medial epicondyle fragment is trapped inside the joint, you have to get it out.
What about those athletes?
Right. Some surgeons also push for surgery in high-demand athletes like gymnasts and throwers, just given the huge forces on their elbows.
And the surgery involves?
Usually involves an open approach, reducing the fracture, putting it back where it belongs, and securing it with a screw into the medial column. You have to be super careful protecting the ulnar nerve nearby. Often surgeons will also augment the repair, maybe suture the UCL and flexor pronator insertion to add stability.
And complications, non-union sounds bad.
Well, complications include loss of motion, and bony non-union rates are actually higher here than other elbow fractures, maybe 15-30%. But here's the key thing. most patients end up with asymptomatic fibrous unions. They heal with scar tissue, not bone, but it doesn't cause problems. So stable fixation allows early motion, which is really the goal to prevent stiffness.
Good point. And remember, everyone, for the deepest dive into these complexities, orthopedia.com is your go-to resource, providing the evidence behind everything we're discussing today. That's orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vayette. And before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us, read the book. All right, let's shift focus again. Lateral condyle fractures. How are these different?
These are different because they're intra-articular, meaning the fracture line goes right into the joint. They typically start in the lateral distal humeral metaphysis and crack into the joint surface.
And what pulls them out of place?
That's the trick. The forearm extensor muscles attach there, and they tend to pull these fragments posteriorly and laterally.
Okay. Second most common, you said?
Yep. Second most common pediatric elbow fracture. But here's the catch. They're frequently missed on initial imaging.
Why is that?
Because a big chunk of that lateral condyle fragment is actually cartilage, which doesn't show up well on x-rays. So you need a seriously high index of suspicion here.
Got it. So presentation.
Patients will typically complain of elbow pain after a fall. On exam, you'll find tenderness right over the lateral elbow and pain when they actively flex or extend their wrist.
And imaging, what views are key?
Standard AP and lateral x-rays are helpful, of course, but the internal oblique radiograph of the elbow is probably the most critical view. It helps diagnose it and really lets you assess the displacement accurately.
And what else might it look like?
The differential diagnosis includes supracondylar humerus fractures and radial neck fractures. They can look similar, especially if they're subtle. So you really need those good views, especially the oblique.
Makes sense. So how are these treated? It seems like displacement is key.
It all hinges on displacement. If a fracture is truly, truly non-displaced on all x-ray views, you might consider non-operative management. Long arm cast, maybe 4 to 6 weeks.
But if there's any displacement?
Then operative treatment is usually preferred, even minimal displacement. These fractures just have a decreased healing potential compared to others.
And the operation.
For minimally displaced ones, especially if you think the articular cartilage, the joint surface cartilage, is still kind of hinged and intact, closed reduction and percutaneous lateral pinning is often the approach. You can even supplement that with a post-reduction arthrogram inject dye into the joint under x-ray to really confirm the reduction and make sure that joint surface is perfectly smooth.
And for bigger displacements?
Significantly displaced fractures, or ones you just can't get back into place closed, need an open reduction. Going through a lateral approach, put the pieces back, and then pin them percutaneously.
Okay. What about complications here? Sounds like these might be trickier.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Yeah.
Lateral condyle fractures do have higher complication rates compared to other pediatric elbow fractures.
Like what?
Stiffness is probably the most common issue, though it often resolves over time. But other things can happen. Delayed union, non-union where it just doesn't heal, osteonecrosis where part of the bone dies from lack of blood supply. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even deformity like cubitus valgus where the elbow angles outward. That can sometimes be accompanied by an ulnar nerve palsy down the line. So these definitely need careful follow-up.
Right. Okay, next up, radial neck fractures. Who gets these?
These tend to occur in a slightly older age group than the typical supracondylar fractures, usually children between 8 and 11 years old.
And they can happen alone.
They can occur in isolation, yeah. But they're also seen pretty frequently with other elbow injuries, like olecranon fractures, breaks of the pointy part of the elbow, or elbow dislocations.
And the anatomy, quick reminder.
Sure. The ossification center, the growth center of the radial head, starts appearing maybe around 3 to 5 years old, but it fuses with the rest of the radial shaft much later, like 16 to 18 years old.
And the mechanism? Fall again?
Usually. Fall onto an outstretched hand, often with the elbow extended, and getting a valgus force again, that force trying to push the forearm outward.
Okay. Clinically, what do you look for?
Patients will present with elbow pain, tenderness right over the radial head, that knobby bit on the thumb side, and specifically pain with elbow motion, especially pronation and supination, turning the palm up and down.
And how do you describe them?
Usually by their degree of angulation relative to the radial shaft. How tilted is the head?
Gotcha. Any pearls here?
Yeah, a vital one. In older children and adolescents, if they have tenderness right over the radial head, but you don't see an obvious fracture on x-rays, you should assume an occult radial head fracture. Treat it like one.
Good tip. Differentials.
Supracondylar and lateral condyle elbow fractures again. And also nursemaid's elbow, though that's usually younger kids.
And red flags.
Compartment syndrome is always a concern, particularly after higher energy injuries or those that happen along with other elbow injuries like a dislocation, always keep it in the back of your mind.
Okay, so a treatment plan for these radial neck fractures.
If they're non-displaced, occult like we just mentioned, or have less than 30 degrees of angulation, you can generally manage them non-operatively with a cast or sling.
More than 30 degrees.
Then you should attempt a closed reduction. You can try this in the ER or take them to the operating room.
Can you use pins to help?
Yeah. In the OR, a percutaneous K-wire, just a small wire through the skin, can be used like a little joystick to help push the fragment back into place and maintain the reduction while you pin it, maybe.
And if that doesn't work?
For severely displaced fractures that just won't reduce with closed techniques, then you might need an open reduction followed by percutaneous pinning to fix them properly.
And the main thing to watch out for afterwards.
The most common complication, unfortunately, is some loss of pronation and horder supination. That rotational movement can be tough to get back fully.
All right, let's transition to something really common and thankfully often easier to fix, nursemaid's elbow. Super common in little ones, right?
Incredibly common, yeah. Mostly you see this between 2 and 3 years old. It gets very uncommon after age 5.
And the mechanism is pretty classic.
Very specific and unique mechanism. The annular ligament, which basically holds the radial head snug against the ulna, it subluxes, partially dislocates, and gets trapped between the radial head and the capitellum.
How does that happen?
Typically happens after a longitudinal pulling force on the forearm while it's pronated, palm down, and the elbow is extended. The classic story is a parent pulling a child's hand quickly, maybe to stop them from falling or running into the street.
Okay, and how do they present?
Classic signs. Pain, refusal to move the elbow. They typically hold it slightly bent, maybe 90 degrees, and with the forearm pronated, palm facing down or inward, they just won't use the arm.
Do you always need x-rays?
Not always. If the history and exam are perfectly classic for nursemaids, you often don't need radiographs.
But when should you get them?
Definitely get x-rays. If there's any elbow deformity, if the mechanism isn't clear, or, importantly, if the child is over 5 years old, you need to rule out other injuries in those cases.
And if you do get x-rays?
They're often completely normal. Sometimes you might see a slight radial head subluxation, but usually normal.
What else could it be mistaken for?
Your differential includes supracondylar or maybe transfyseal humerus fractures, radial neck fractures, or even rare congenital things like radial neuron synostosis.
So the red flags again are deformity, unknown mechanism, or over age 5.
Exactly. Those warrant imaging.
Okay, the good part.
Yeah.
Treatment.
Yeah, this is one of the most satisfying injuries to treat in medicine, honestly. It's usually easily resolved with simple closed reduction maneuvers.
What are the main techniques?
There are two common ones. One is hyperpronation.
Hmm.
You hold the elbow bent at 90 degrees and firmly twist the forearm so the palm faces even further down. The other is the supination flexion method. You firmly supinate the forearm, turn the palm up, and then fully flex the elbow.
And you feel a click.
Usually, yeah. You'll often feel or sometimes even hear a distinct click as that annular ligament pops back into place.
And the kid feels better right away.
It's often dramatic. Immediate relief. The child frequently starts using their elbow again, almost instantly. It's really rewarding to see.
Any follow-up needed? Cast?
Nope. No further immobilization or treatment is needed after a successful reduction. Outcomes are typically excellent, no lasting issues.
Does it happen again?
Recurrence can sometimes be seen, especially in the younger toddlers, but it usually doesn't happen again after the age of 5 when the ligament gets stronger.
Uh-huh.
It's just a testament to knowing the mechanism and having a simple technique.
Great. Okay, our final deep dive into specific injuries. Both bone forearm fractures. Tell us about the anatomy basics here.
Right. The radius and ulna together form a crucial ring structure in the forearm. They transmit forces from the wrist up to the elbow, especially during things like a fall.
And how do we describe these fractures?
Typically described by their location, like distal third, middle third, proximal third, the direction of the angulation, and whether they're complete breaks or incomplete, like a green stick fracture.
What's a green stick again?
It's essentially a partial break, where only one side of the bone cortex cracks, kind of like bending a young green tree branch. The other side just bends.
Got it. And growth is important here.
Very important. While both bones have growth plates at both ends, it's the distal physis, the growth plate near the wrist, in both the radius and ulna, that accounts for the vast majority of forearm growth, like 75-80%.
Which means?
It means fractures closer to the wrist have a much greater potential for remodeling, basically, correcting their own angulation as the child grows after healing. More potential than fractures closer to the elbow.
Okay. presentation, usually obvious.
Patients with these typically present with pretty obvious forearm pain and deformity after a fall. Can't miss it, usually.
But what's crucial on the exam?
Absolutely crucial to thoroughly check both the wrist and the elbow for any associated injuries. You have to make sure it's not just a straightforward forearm fracture.
What are those associated injuries?
The important differential diagnoses here include an isolated distal radius fracture, sure, but also a Galeazzi fracture that's a radial shaft fracture combined with a dislocation of the distal radialar joint down at the wrist, or a Montagia fracture that's an ulna fracture, usually proximal, with an associated dislocation of the radial head up at the elbow.
Ah, so you have to look above and below.
Always. And remember, if a patient has a forearm fracture but also complains of elbow pain, that's a major red flag for a concomitant subpocalar fracture.
Yeah.
If it's your floating elbow scenario again.
Right. Any other red flags for forearm fractures?
Persistently oozing wounds. That signals an open fracture, which needs immediate irrigation in the OR and antibiotics to prevent infection.
Okay. Imaging.
AP and lateral radiographs of the entire forearm are essential, obviously.
Hmm.
But remember to get additional dedicated radiographs of the elbow and the wrist, specifically to rule out those associated injuries like Montegia and Galeazzi. Look at the whole limb.
Good advice. Now, treatment. Different in kids versus adults.
Big difference. While both bone forearm fractures in adults often require surgery, plates, and screws, in children, they're frequently more stable.
Why is that?
Because kids have this thick, often intact periosteum, that strong fibrous membrane covering the bone. It acts almost like an internal sleeve or cast.
So non-op is common?
Yes. It often allows for non-operative treatment with just closed reduction, setting the bones back in place and casting.
When do you operate on kids?
Surgical treatment is generally reserved for fractures where the alignment just remains unacceptable even after you try to reduce it, or maybe for adolescents who are nearing skeletal maturity and have less of that remodeling potential left.
Then outcomes, generally good.
Typically very satisfactory, yeah. At most, kids might have a mild loss of motion, particularly pronation or supination, but usually no significant functional deficits. It really is a testament to how well kids heal.
Fantastic. Okay, now to bring it all together, let's quickly revisit five key terms that are really on the road to understanding these injuries. These are the nuggets you definitely want to take away.
Absolutely. Let's recap. First, supracondylar humerus fractures. The insight here is just how common they are, number one, and the absolute necessity of that meticulous neurovascular assessment. Remember, subtle issues with the AIN nerve, the ulnar nerve, or brachial artery flow can dictate urgent intervention and really change the outcome. Don't get tunnel vision. Always check nerves and pulses.
Okay. Then there's the floating elbow. This isn't just descriptive. It's a critical red flag. It practically screams compartment syndrome risk. That combo of an ipsilateral supracondylar fracture and a forearm fracture means you absolutely must have a heightened level of vigilance. That's a situation you don't want to miss.
Couldn't agree more. Next, radial neck fractures. These are distinct because of their potential impact on elbow motion, specifically pronation and supination. Understanding their angulation, knowing about potential occult presentations in older kids, that's key. And remember, loss of that rotation is the most common complication, really emphasizing why careful reduction matters.
Fourth, nursemaid's elbow. This one really stands out. Unique mechanism, that annular ligament getting trapped, strong age specificity in the little toddlers. And of course, the immediate, often dramatic relief you see with those simple, non-invasive reduction maneuvers. It's one of those instant gratification moments in medicine, which is nice.
It really is. And finally, both bone forearm fractures. The key takeaway here is the significant difference in pediatric management compared to adults. Kids often do great non-operatively because of their thick periosteum and just amazing remodeling potential. But crucially, always, always rule out associated injuries at the elbow and risk those Galeazzi or Montegia fractures because they can drastically alter your whole management plan.
Excellent summary. We have just discussed a chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook of musculoskeletal medicine,
Orthopedia
by Bernstein, Pinney, and Viet. It is available at www.orthopedia.com at no charge. And again, before you take a test and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book. You'll be glad you did.
Absolutely. And maybe just a final thought to leave you with as you move forward, really consider this. How do the specific growth plates, the physis, and the unique biomechanics of a child's growing skeleton fundamentally influence not just these specific injury patterns we talked about today, but also their incredible healing potential and ultimately your overall treatment philosophy? Thinking about these unique pediatric considerations will really deepen your understanding of trauma far beyond just the bones themselves. It's a different world than adult ortho in many ways.